Well, the new year is just a few days old, but the state's economy continues to face challenges. What are the challenges and the opportunities for 2012? Today on the program, we'll hear from a panel of experts who will share their visions of Maine's economy in the year ahead. And we'd like to hear from you as well. First, to our guests, though, joining me in our Portland studios today, Charlie Colgan of the Muskie School of Public Service, University of Southern Maine, Dana Connors, president of the Maine Chamber of Commerce, and Garrett Martin, executive director of the Maine Center for Economic Policy. I'm Keith Shortall. Welcome to our guests. Thanks for being here today. I'd like you to, if you'd like to join the program, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, email to talk@mpbn.net, or message us on Facebook. Let's get right to it. Charlie Colgan, give us the pocket version of where we are in terms of, you know, Maine's economy right now and what you see going forward into 2012.
Well, if you look at the Maine economy right now, the benchmark is obviously where are we in terms of a recovery from the Great Recession. And the answer is not as far as we would like to be. Progress from in 2011 has been halting at best. We've gained a little bit over the jobs that we were at the bottom of the recession, but not many. And 2012 looks to be pretty stagnant at the moment without a lot of job growth in 2012, because the same forces that have been restraining the national economy through 2011 essentially are going to play through all of 2012. The one big thing is that the economy has become very volatile, with kind of underlying trying to grow but being choked off by crises in Europe or in Washington or in other places. We can't quite figure out exactly where all those are going to be in 2012, but it's a pretty good guess that there's going to be enough of them that we won't make as much progress as we need to in recovery.
Dana Connors, Garrett Martin, anything to add from your perspectives?
Garrett.
Well, I think Charlie hit the nail on the head. I think the combination of federal gridlock and state-level austerity measures and, you know, what happens in Europe certainly mean that our economy is going to remain in neutral, or possibly, unfortunately, even shift back into reverse. So,
yeah, I guess I wouldn't dispute that for a second. It's we're in a very complex as well as challenging economy. Trying to reduce it to its simplest terms is anything but impossible. I am finding and have found from time to time glimmers of hope that you'll see signs, and this is more anecdotal than it is factual. Mm-hmm. Charlie, who we all know and love and has done this job for a long time and does it extremely well, will provide all the analysis, and I can't and wouldn't dispute that for a second. I am from the Chamber of Commerce, however, and I want to see the positive side to everything, because, in fact, consumer confidence, the spirit and spending that goes with consumer confidence, is a very important element. So I've been encouraged from time to time. In fact, was up about the time of the debt ceiling debate and then the stock market reaction to that, everybody that was kind of venturing out of that place they were in of conservative approach went right back to where they were. And so there is this, add to the complexity, this anxiety that goes around, is this over yet and what do we see? So there's a lot of pent-up anxiety, frustration, unawareness, and I don't think we in our lifetime have seen anything quite like that. And that does inhibit the growth or the potential for growth.
1-800-399-3566, the number to call to join the conversation. I want to ask about forecasts in general and why we do them. It's the new year, so forecasts of all sorts are all the rage. But do they play a role in helping us guide public policy or make even business decisions?
Well, I think that forecasts are mostly important in terms of helping people understand what the forces shaping the future are. The actual pinpoint numbers, if you ask me, you know, exactly how many jobs there will be in Maine a year from now, I can give you a mathematically derived number, but I don't necessarily believe it. But I can talk about the things that went into making that number, and that's going to help you understand exactly how the forces are playing out over this next year. And it will also help you understand what to pay attention to over the next year in terms of the things shaping the Maine economy, and make your own judgments about whether things are getting better or worse. So the principal virtue of forecasts is mostly in helping us better understand the forces at work shaping the future rather than picking a precise number at some point in the future.
Help us to understand the one indicator that we hear so often is unemployment. Help us to sort of school us a little, if you would, Charlie, on unemployment, and all of you. What is it that we're really measuring, and is it a valuable indicator? Does it deserve the attention that it gets?
Unemployment is the unemployment rate is the percentage of a surveyed part of the population done every month, and it's the proportion of the people who say they are out of work but are looking for work. The total number of people in the workforce is the people employed plus the number of people who are out of work and looking for work, and those are the unemployed. The people who are not looking for work, who are retired, too young, or have simply left the labor market, are out of the labor force. The unemployment rate is a very good measure of macro performance, but it's a very bad measure of time to time because the labor force changes, and so the denominator changes. We've seen in both the U.S. and in Maine over the past year, the unemployment rate has come down, but that's because the labor force has shrunk because people have left the labor force. They've essentially stopped looking for work. So the proportion of people who are unemployed and looking for work is a smaller number, a smaller proportion of that smaller workforce. And this is the thing that gets the most attention in terms of the unemployment rate as a messy indicator, is that the numbers on which it is based are actually very, very good statistically, but the measurement is of a very precise concept that does not fully reflect all the things going on in the labor market.
And if I may, Keith, I think that what Charlie points to is something that's really important for folks to bear in mind, because since January of 2011, we've actually lost jobs in this state. We're down 4,500 jobs from where we were at the beginning of the year, even though our unemployment rate has dropped. And I think what that points to from an analytic perspective is, again, understanding what are the dynamics of that decline in unemployment if jobs are indeed going down. But the other piece that the unemployment figure doesn't tell the full story of is the underemployment potential. So there are a lot of folks out there, for instance, who would like full-time work but are only able to find part-time work. There are a lot of folks who have skills that in a labor market that was more robust, if you will, that would be attracting a better wage but aren't getting the kind of wage that they would expect or benefits. And so I think it's a useful measure, but going back to whether it's unemployment or the forecasting, at some level we have to, at the end of the day, say this is what we're aiming for in terms of our economic outcomes as a state, and let's understand what those are, be clear about that, and then figure out the best possible way to get there.
1-800-399-3566 or talk@mpbn.net. Dana, did you?
Well, everything that's been said is absolutely accurate, and it's one of the things that we all struggle with. I mean, it's not to take the conversation in a different area, but when we see all these reports about where Maine ranks or what the unemployment is, they're all used to compare ourselves to other states. So when I find, even with that explanation, which I'm aware of, that we are a part of a national economy, we're struggling in many of the same ways that other states are. In this instance, our unemployment, notwithstanding the explanation, can be construed as kind of a positive thing in that very limited definition. But my point is that when you – wasn't so long ago, and again, being from the Chamber of Commerce, I'm going to try to point out as many positive things, because in truth, what we're trying to do is to encourage people to see the positive so that that translates into a little more investment, another job here and there, the policies that help to move our state forward. And when you look at a recent report that put us as the lowest state in the nation for the second year in the row, you take all of that, I guess that's what we're all saying, with a grain of salt. But where there are positive features, it behooves us to try to bring that forward, because there's one thing, having lived here my entire life, and I'm going to tell you how long that's been, but you know me, so you know how long that's been, is that we're very good at pointing out our problems and dissecting our state into the many issues that confront us and hold us back. We don't do a very good job of really promoting the positive, putting things out there as many other states do to try to attract business. And if I had one wish, it would be that we focus on the issues that compel us, but we also try to promote the things that are positive about us, because it is about balance. It is about the positive as well as negative.
I want to talk about the Forbes ranking, yeah, which is one of those that we've got a lot of attention in the media. But I also want to follow up on something that Charlie mentioned earlier about this group of people who are dropping out of the unemployment formula because they've ceased looking for work. And I'm trying to imagine what it is. Like, what are they doing? So are they on unemployment, or they have no income? Where are they, and how do we find them to count them?
Well, we find them because we do this on a household survey basis. We have a valid sample of households in Maine, and that's how we can find them. What are they doing? Mostly, most of them are living off of their spouses or partners. They're two income households, and one partner has an income and the other one doesn't. Or they've shifted all the way down the income spectrum and have essentially they've exhausted their unemployment benefits, because those are going to be included. You have to be looking for work to get unemployment insurance, unemployment benefits. So they've shifted all the way down into full dependence on the state.
And I think Charlie's point is an important one, because, you know, one of the issues we know as a result of this recession is that there are a lot of folks who do want to work, who have done the things that they thought they should do in terms of getting an education, or are really out there pounding the pavement looking for jobs, who are unable to find the kinds of jobs that are going to help them make ends meet for their families. And with that in mind, I think one of our imperatives right now is to recognize that reality, and to be sure in our current discourse about where we go as a state, that we are concerned at some level with minimizing the damage. Because in truth, to strip away some of the supports that many families rely on to either remain in the workforce or to be a buffer to some of the challenges they face in the current economy could have lasting consequences for those families and for our economy. And so I think that's an important thing to bear in mind, that minimizing the damage is a key component.
How much of Maine's problem is unemployment, and how much of it is matching people with jobs for which they have the skills?
I think, Keith, you've hit on one area of positive opportunity, certainly, is that there are definitely skilled manufacturing, high-end manufacturing jobs that are out there that pay good wages, for which, for whatever reasons, those employers have had a hard time filling. That said, the reality of the situation is, by and large, for most job openings, there is, for a single job opening in some sectors, there's as many as 40 applicants. I think the average number nationwide is something like for every single job opening, there are 4 applicants. So while it is true that there are certainly some jobs out there that we want to make sure we have the workforce in place to take advantage of, the bigger story is really one of a lack of jobs. And with that in mind, we really, again, need to be doing everything we can to bring jobs online. And that includes things like issuing bonds that allow for infrastructure investment. That includes doing things, for instance, through our tax policies that put hands in the money of people who are likely to put that money back to work in the economy and increase consumption. But the long term, I think the point, and I suspect Dana would agree with this, is that we do have a concern about our workforce in Maine and what we're doing with our educational systems to align the skills and capacities of our workforce with the needs of high-end, high-quality jobs. And that's ultimately where the high road is for Maine, is making sure we preserve those investments and position people to take advantage of those opportunities.
Well said. You're agreeing.
Oh, totally. I mean, it's both issues. I mean, you've got to actually prepare our economy, know where we're headed, and make sure that our assets meet the direction that we've established for our economy. And that may sound overly simplistic, but that's a challenge in and of itself, because economic development can be faddish in nature. And just because something is working in Arizona doesn't mean it has a chance, and you know where, to work in Maine. And what are our greatest assets? What are the things that are going to work best for us? How can we take ourselves to this international stage and effectively compete? We know the quality of our products are not surpassed. We know the quality of our workforce cannot be surpassed, and the quality of our place. I mean, that is our brand. But I'd also say, picking up on what Garrett has mentioned, that I frankly come across businesses more than you'd suspect that really are saying, you know, there's got to be a realignment in our educational system. Somehow we need to continue to encourage people to seek the highest education possible, but education is not one-dimensional. You also have to find, particularly in manufacturing, that you respect those jobs for what they bring to our economy and you prepare the workforce to meet them. Because if I were to reflect on those voices that I hear most often lacking the worker that has the skill to fit those jobs, it's in the manufacturing. And I think that there is a lot that we can do, and I suspect we're going to see a lot of that in the next session.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and on the other side, we will take your calls. The number again, 1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation or talk at mpbn.net. Back in a moment.
The Republicans running for president have worked hard to win support in Iowa.
We're in Iowa. We're going to be here a lot.
Iowans are going to send the signal.
Isn't it great to be at the Iowa State Fair?
Now the time has come for Iowans to choose a favorite. I'm Robert Siegel. Join us later today for results and analysis, live coverage of the Iowa caucuses from NPR News.
MPBN's coverage gets underway at 8 o'clock this evening with All Things Considered, followed at 9 with live wall-to-wall coverage from Iowa. MPBN Television will also air an Iowa caucus special this evening at 11.
When Stephen Hawking was diagnosed with ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, in 1963, doctors predicted an early death. But now a 70th birthday party is in the works to celebrate his life and his remarkable contributions to cosmology and theoretical physics. We'll talk with Hawking's biographer, Kitty Ferguson, on the next Fresh Air.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock.
I'm Keith Shortall. With me, guests, Charlie Colgan of the Muskie School of Public Service at the University of Southern Maine, Dana Connors, president of the Maine State Chamber of Commerce, and Garrett Martin, executive director of the Maine Center for Economic Policy. And we're talking about the economy in 2012, the challenges and the opportunities. Let's go to Nathan in West Bath. Hi, Nathan.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
You guys have opened up so many different points that I want to talk on. Hopefully I can get a minute or two. First off, talk about education. I have a daughter who goes to Morris High School. And because of the structure of the school, you know, the grading system allows her to get a 60 and still pass. When I was in school, it was a 70. So one of the easiest things to cut when it comes to taxes and so on and so forth is education, because it affects, quote-unquote, the least vocal. Secondly, I had the opportunity through the AFL-CIO back on December 8th to go down and actually speak with Senator Snow. I was able to hold her ear for 45 minutes in her office, and we touched upon the tax breaks for the middle class and so on and so forth. Well, I'm actually in the process of reading a book by Harry Dent, and his outlook on the Keynesian economics building blocks that we've based this economy on is between the $15 trillion of debt that we have with the federal government, the multi-trillion dollar debts that we have throughout the states, and the 45-plus trillion dollar debts we have in private, that there really isn't a hole to dig out of anymore. We are so cratered that we are going to go into a free fall.
Nathan, let me let our guests in here, and we'll let you continue in a second. But
absolutely.
Let's get at the debt question. We do hear so often, you know, the debt. That's a priority number one, and yet it seems hopeless. Charlie Colgan, how important is this debt issue internationally, nationally, and how does it affect us here in Maine?
Well, as everyone remembers, the depression following World War II, when the 1950s were this terrible lost decade because of the debt we incurred to fight World War II, which was roughly three times what we're doing now. You know, that story never occurred, and it didn't occur because we grew after World War II. The American economy at roughly $14 trillion a year, it's about 1-to-1 in terms of the total amount we owe versus our annual income, which is actually much less than many people have in terms of their household income versus their household debt. So we can get out of this without a lot of difficulty if we can get the economy moving again, which is why that has to be the first priority, is to get the economy moving again. Otherwise, we are just fighting with each other over a fixed share of debt and income. So the debt is a problem. I think the debt doomsayers have overstated the problem. We can easily handle the debts that we have incurred if we can get sustained growth. The problem is that our choice is to not grow by largely choosing, as Europe has done, an austerity in which households, businesses, government all choose to cut back. If you do that, there's no money to pay the debt.
1-800-399-3566. Nathan, did you have one last question?
I had one last point. I'm an unemployed electrician. I'm with the IBEW. And I'm seeing around me, I'm just seeing the fact that the infrastructure, I mean, we just had a big battle down at BIW. CCB, the current general contractor down there, actually had to, play bluff with BIW and General Dynamics in order to complete a job, in order to just build this, get the tools online for to build this DDG 1000. We are constantly robbing Peter to pay Paul. I mean, you're talking about austerity. I mean, how can our governor, after 4 years of being in office, how can we support his medical needs for the rest of his life when they're asking us to constantly lose? I mean, there is a very huge imbalance when it comes to business and the larger group of people. And until we come to grips with that and stop this robbing of the coffers, I guess. I mean, when you play the sleight of hand with our funding for our pensions, we'll give you an IOU and expect to pay it in the future when the tax revenue is not there. We give big business breaks. Look what they did with Walmart up in Lewiston.
Yeah, Nathan, thanks for calling. I want to bring our guests in and also go to some other callers. But clearly there's some frustration out there. People who are unemployed and wondering about really the fairness of how things have all settled out.
Well, I mean, it is about balance. As he appropriately pointed out, is that when do you make the investments that are necessary, and where do you make the investments that are necessary to move the economy forward? At the same time, the public, because they're feeling this pinch, this economic, it's more than a pinch, to be sure, they're demanding that government control its spending. So you can't ignore one to the loss of the other. We've got to be sure that we do get our spending house in order. But we also have to be sure that it doesn't come at the loss of making those critical investments in our economy, because without growing the economy, those concerns around the debt that we have, those concerns around the unemployment that we have, will just simply grow and blossom, and it'll become far worse if we think it's bad today. So there is that balance. That's the hardest, most difficult challenge to meet, is when does one stop and the other begin, and what do you pick as priorities? I do think, that what Garrett pointed to in terms of the, he didn't say it specifically, but clearly mentioning the challenge of providing services that are going to be forthcoming to this legislature starting tomorrow, dealing with the Medicaid cuts. But certainly, I think beyond that, I think we all can expect that education will be one of the priorities established, that we know it's going to be about energy, and we know how energy is a serious cost issue for the public in the state of Maine, not just the employer, but the employees as well.
Keith, I'd like to just add, I think Nathan, for me, touches on two realities. One is that there were forces at play long before this recession that was causing more and more people to feel squeezed in this economy. You know, going back to the late 1970s, we've seen increases in productivity that have been consistent with where we've been historically. But what we've not seen is increases in wages that parallel those increases in productivity. So many folks have seen their wages stagnate, even leading into the recession. And I think the recession merely heightened that sense of frustration. I think what is unfortunate is that we've allowed the stress and the fear that has caused many families and many bodies of politics or whatever you want to call it to react in a way, as Charlie, I think, spoke to, that almost becomes a reinforcement of the challenges we face. We've got to be careful that we don't do the reverse Robin Hood thing and put more people in a more difficult situation when we have the capacity and we have the ability to make choices that, again, recognize the situation we're in and ultimately put us on a path towards longer-term prosperity. And that's the conversation we need to be having.
1-800-399-3566 or talk@mpbn.net. Let's go to Arnold in Lebanon. Hi, Arnold.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I was wondering if anybody's done any projections for the following year here on which sectors of the main economy are going to grow and which are going to lose jobs.
I bet we have someone right here just by coincidence.
By coincidence.
So my forecast, at least, the job gainers over the next year, really over the next several years, will be healthcare, though in my forecast I've significantly reduced the growth rate of healthcare from its historic levels, largely because of issues like Medicaid and worries about the public side of medical funding. So healthcare, professional and business services, and leisure and hospitality are the three sectors that will get most of the jobs. Manufacturing will get a little bit of job growth. The losing sectors will be construction will remain weak and probably go down as some big energy projects wind down. Retail trade will remain weak as some of the big box stores close down. And the big loser will be government at both the state and local levels.
Well, you mentioned health care, and I assume much of that is driven by the aging population? Or
there are two things that are going on in health care. One is the prolonged nature of this recession has left an awful lot of people without health insurance, and so there's been a reduction in the demand for health care services, including hospital services, and that has cut into the growth rate, not a absolute reduction in jobs, but it's cut into the growth rate of health care. And the other issue is cuts on the public side, both from federal and state budget issues.
1-800-399-3566 or talk@mpbn.net. Danny, you had a comment?
Well, I mean, Charlie reminds me of something that, you know, as Maine Development Foundation, the State Chamber of Commerce put together kind of a roadmap for our new legislature and our new governor. One of the things that struck me in that report, it goes back to what one of us had mentioned early on, and it has to do with the economy, but it also has to do with the aging of our population and how we really need to keep our eye on our young people to prepare them, whether it's by education or whatever the means to be competitive and to compete and give them the opportunity. Because when you look at our population today and then project it out for the next 20 years, it is seen as being relatively flat, if any growth, minimal. But here's the concern, is that we're already the oldest state in the nation with a median age of around 43 years of age. And the next 20 years with a flat population, those over 60, 65 are growing significantly to the loss of those under, which means the workforce today is a workforce tomorrow. But how do we start to reverse that? How do we create a welcoming economy so that we bring people in, we grow our population, and we also prepare our population for the economy? To me, that's one of our most daunting challenges. If you don't have a population, then it's pretty hard to do what we want to do in the forthcoming years.
Charlie, talk a little bit more about the changing demographics. It's getting older, it's relatively flat, and I understand it will be growing more in urban centers as opposed to in
Yes. The 2010 census showed for the first time in really four decades, the urban centers of Maine, Bangor, Lewiston, Portland, all growing in population. And that's a big change, though and most of the growth was within the metropolitan areas. We are the oldest state in the nation, but statistically we're the oldest mostly because of a lack of young people, not because of a wildly disproportionate number of old people. And Dana's quite right to focus on the issue of young people, which is really kind of threefold. In terms of the workforce, we're not going to get a large number of young people coming in. But we do need to increase that. So we need to do three things. One is we have to focus on the quality of our workforce because we can't compete on quantity. Secondly, we have to do more to retain people within Maine, and we've got to attract people to come to Maine who are younger. And incidentally, we've been able to do that. Recent data from the census suggests that over half the people who moved to Maine from 2005 to 2009 were under 35 and came in with college degrees or better. So we are capable of doing that. We are capable of getting young people to move to Maine with advanced degrees and make up some of the workforce needs that we're going to have. But the recession put an end to that, by the way, because all mobility essentially stopped. But as we come out of the recession, we're really going to have to focus on attracting and retaining the workforce and making a much better quality younger workforce because they're not going to be able to compete on quantity. That's going to be the biggest issue workers are going to face or businesses are going to face in the latter part of this decade is just finding people who can do the work.
We're going to take a quick break, 1-800-399-3566 or talk@mpbn.net to join the conversation. We'll be back in a moment.
On the next Ian Rehm Show, in 1992, the FDA ruled against requiring labels on foods with genetically modified ingredients. For this month's Environmental Outlook, why some believe that decision should be reconsidered.
Join us for the Diane Rehm Show this afternoon at 2 o'clock. They spend millions on their campaigns, but believe it or not, GOP presidential hopefuls are getting a real bargain this time around.
We'll have these outside groups promoting specific candidates, and that really becomes an extension of the candidate's campaign.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Why campaigns are flush with cash for now. That's next time on Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. And you can hear Marketplace tonight at 6:30.
And welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall with Charlie Colgan of the Muskie School of Public Service at USM, Dana Connors, president of the Maine State Chamber of Commerce, and Garrett Martin, executive director of the Maine Center for Economic Policy. We're talking about the Maine economy in 2012, and now we are talking with Arthur in Hartford Center. Hi, Arthur. Go ahead. Arthur, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Yes. What's your question?
Well, a lot of the discussion seems to be based on the assumption that the economy can continue to grow indefinitely. And it seems to me that this is doubtful. The rate of expansion worldwide has been gradually decreasing in recent generations. And it seems to me that this is a result of, first of all, an increased rate of population growth, coupled with a loss of productive farmland, a loss of productive woodlands, a loss of a supply of fresh water. Of course, these factors vary a lot from place to place. But looking at the economy overall, even just looking at the United States economy, these factors seem to indicate that continued growth is simply not going to be possible indefinitely, whether it's going to stop in 10 years or 20 years or some other length of time, I have no idea. But it seems to me we've got to start figuring, calculating on the basis that it is not going to increase.
Sure. Arthur, let me ask Charlie, what about Arthur's premise that the economy just simply cannot continue to expand?
This is an old argument going back to Malthus in the 19th century. And the answer to it is that as one of the things we've learned is that as resources get scarce, if we let their prices rise to reflect the scarcity, we will find other ways to meet those needs. So if water gets expensive, we'll make it more expensive and people will conserve it. If energy gets expensive, we'll find other sources of energy and we'll conserve energy. So the argument that there are these resource constraints, at some level, they're at some infinite level, they're probably true, but we are a long way from them because we have continually, as long as we've allowed prices to signal scarcity and the need to change, we have found, we have innovated our way into doing things differently and have not yet found those limits.
I want to talk about some of the things that we can and cannot control here in the Northeast, for example. The cost of energy, very difficult to control, the temperature, the weather. And yet in Augusta right now playing out are, I think, some attempts to bring the budget under control. The governor's vision is to first tackle a deficit in social services, which is very controversial. And I don't think we have the time to go through all of that. But how significant is this debate to Maine's economy in 2012?
Keith, I think this is hugely significant to Maine's economy in 2012 for a couple of different reasons. For starters, we have to make sure our diagnosis of the problem is accurate. And I would argue in this case, this is a misdiagnosis. For starters, we crafted a budget that was passed with bipartisan support that was based on a set of assumptions that now are not holding up. The other thing that's interesting is we, in inflation-adjusted terms, our general fund spending now is actually lower than it was in 1998. So the notion that somehow we've let our Medicaid expenditure get out of control is again, not an accurate one. We have a revenue problem in truth. And the current course of action really raises some interesting questions about how do we approach these issues in ways that really reflect the interest of all Maine people, and what are the implications for long-term economic prospects? So going back to the statement I made earlier that, you know, first thing we need to be concerned with is minimizing the damage. And I think it's clear that access to health care, whether it be for an aging parent that you have, and if you suddenly have to take them on and you're trying to maintain a full-time job, well, that's a problem. If you have a child who's disabled and is relying on Maine care and you suddenly have to take on responsibility for dealing with them, that's a challenge. If you have people in communities who are struggling to get by and lose their access to health care and then start accessing that care in very inefficient ways, i.e. in the emergency room, that's going to result in a cost shift that affects everybody. So I think it at an individual level, it creates some issues, and at a societal and economic level, it creates issues. And then there's the very real fact that if you take that $221 million, which is the current figure, and it could change next week for all we know, out of the economy in combination with the federal dollars that come down, we know that that will result in job losses. So at a time when we are most concerned about jobs and most concerned about taking our economy in a forward direction, we're looking at proposals that I would argue potentially take us backward. The other thing I just want to put a fine point on, too, is that next up on this conversation is going to be what do we do about bonds and how do we preserve investments in other areas of our economy to position ourselves for future success.
You know, the governor has sort of said for the first 2 years of administration he would not engage in borrowing, even for, you know, transportation infrastructure. Dana, where do your constituents come down on that?
Well, you're talking to the wrong person when you ask about bonds for highways, bridges, and transportation, because I spent 11 years advocating for that. So it's hard to walk away from it. I think that, again, he has said that. I felt a bit of an open door in terms of consideration this year for bonds, limited in scope, but clearly transportation, infrastructure type of investments. I'm not so sure now. I mean, I heard the governor as early as this morning indicate that the department had come up with an extra $104 million that would be applied to construction. So that's kind of a wait and see. But clearly, we are on record as seeing investment and infrastructure in particular as meeting all the tests. It generates revenue. It puts people to work. At the end of the day, you see something as a result of it, and it serves the economy. I mean, that to me is a win-win in many ways, notwithstanding the fact I was transportation and this was my ministry for 11 years. But I do think it's one of those issues of the session. But I think energy is going to be a top-line item, the governor's education.
What about regulation? We heard the governor early on in his administration say this was going to be a big priority. He has taken some steps to kind of make the process for getting licenses and permitting and for doing business as the way he sees it to be a more efficient, easier, consumer-friendly. Yep. Will that really have an impact?
Oh, absolutely it will. I can already tell you that it's had an impact. I think a lot of the regulatory issue, and we weighed on this because, once again, it's about balance. It's about improving the process but not destroying the environment. The business community wants both. They want the environment because it's part of their successful efforts, but they also want an efficient process. It was as much about perhaps a bad choice of words, but attitude or culture as it was about the regulation. Sure, there were some that were outdated, but it was more about the predictability of the process. And I think great improvements have been made there.
We have time for one more call. We're going to go to Christine in Kennebunkport. Hi, Christine. Go ahead quickly, please, if you can go with your question quickly.
Okay. Hi. Thank you. Just a comment. My comment is that I'm just wondering how many young people are actually moving to Maine. You said with college degrees or graduate degrees are moving back home because of this extended adolescence that's taken place now because of the greater economy in the country. I moved here to Maine in 1995 with a graduate degree and have found it very, very challenging to earn a livable wage in Maine. And you know, it's something that I consider when my kids are ready to launch to college. Will they ever come back to Maine?
Sure. Charlie, and our guests, how many kids are moving back into their old room with their old banners on the wall still?
We know the numbers are up during the recession. My own son moved back to Maine after graduate school at the University of Washington in the aftermath of the 2001 recession, and he left Maine to do his work after that. So it's an issue. It's up over the last couple of years. It will probably take us until the latter part of this decade before that begins to turn around.
Well, I'm afraid we're out of time. We could go on for hours here. Yeah. But thank you, all of you. Charlie Colgan of the Muskie School of Public Service, the University of Southern Maine. Dana Connors, president of the Maine State Chamber of Commerce, and Garrett Martin, executive director of the Maine Center for Economic Policy. Thanks again.